supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
For Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. More troops return home from Iraq and Afghanistan every day, showing more psychiatric symptoms like post-traumatic stress disorder. And still, despite the problems that many of our vets face, many avoid treatment, and unfortunately, many who do seek treatment, it's not available. So, what are the difficulties in readjusting to regular life? Why do so many symptoms go unreported? And there's a way that this war is different from other wars. The impact is different. We're going to find out those details, and we're going to find out about new therapies and very effective therapies that are being developed for trauma. Joining me to discuss these questions and many more is Dr. Matthew J. Friedman. He's Executive Director of the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. He's also the author of After the War Zone, A Practical Guide for Returning Troops and Their Family. Matthew Friedman, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined on the phone by Dr. Patricia Riesick. She's Director of Women's Health Division of the National Center for PTSD. She's also a professor of psychiatry and psychology at Boston University. Patricia Riesick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And later on, we're going to hear from Jennifer Crane. She's a vet who returned from a combat tour in Afghanistan, and she'll share her story of PTSD with us. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you are a vet or a loved one of a vet who's experienced PTSD or other symptoms upon returning from war, give us a call. That's 888-477-9499. Matthew Friedman, let's start with you. Before we get to PTSD in the military, let's take a look at this and tell us what it really is and what it's not.
Well, that's a good question to start off with. PTSD has been an official diagnosis of the American Psychiatric Association since 1980. It's undergone some, I would say, relatively minor revisions since that time, but the major construct is that when men, women, and children are exposed to a psychologically overwhelming, terrifying, life-threatening situation, that they are changed. They are changed behaviorally, emotionally, how they see the world, how they think about themselves. Some of these changes we're finding can be seen in how the brain processes information, how the body reacts to a potential threat. So that's basically what the PTSD is about. It consists. So the first the first criterion is that you had to be there. You had to be in one of these situations, and you had to react with a intense, overwhelming emotional reaction. And then there are three symptom clusters. The first cluster is what we call the re-experiencing symptoms, and that is that the event has a life of its own. 10, 20 decades later, people are still thinking about the event. They're trying to listen to this radio program, and they can't stop thinking about what happened during the war, when they were raped, or when they were in a hostage situation, or what have you. They have traumatic nightmares. They might have a PTSD flashback, which is like being in a time machine. All of a sudden, you're back in the event. Reminders of the event can activate intense emotional and physiological reactions. Their heart will start to race. They'll start to sweat. So that's the first cluster. The second cluster is what we call the avoidant numbing symptoms. These re-experiencing symptoms are so unbearable, they're so intolerable, that people will do almost anything not to have to re-experiencing them, so that they will try to distract their thoughts if they're starting to think about the traumatic event. They'll avoid situations. If they're a vet or a soldier, they might not listen to the evening newscast or go to certain movies if they think it's going to remind them of what happened in the war zone. They may be unable to recall certain aspects of the event, or they shut down emotionally. They just can't, so they can't feel the guilt, the shame, the terror. But the problem with that is when you shut down the negative emotions, you shut down the positive emotions. You can't feel love, you can't feel friendship, you can't feel enjoyment.
Well,
they isolate themselves.
Like a colleague of mine once said, all buried emotions are buried alive.
Well, that's a good statement.
So what's the third cluster?
The third cluster are the arousal symptoms. They're sort of on a hyper arousal state. They can't sleep. They can't think because they're thinking about the traumatic material. They may be irritable. They're what we call hypervigilant. They're constantly on guard to make sure that they're never again going to find themselves in such a situation. And they're very, very jumpy and startled.
Well, Patricia, let me turn to you, because all of these symptoms that Matthew described are certainly on a continuum. And not everyone who experiences trauma, of course, develops PTSD. I mean, I've had a couple of traumas in my life. One was a catastrophic automobile accident that left me a quadriplegic. And I listened to Matthew, and I've got some of the symptoms on a continuum. I'm a little bit more vigilant, but my vigilance has saved my life. It's helped me, you know, anticipate future problems. I don't think I have PTSD, though.
Right. You're absolutely right. They do fall on a continuum. And in fact, most people who have traumas happen to them don't develop PTSD. There seems to be a dose, what we call a dose response syndrome, is that the more traumas you happen to that happen to you, the more likely you are to have PTSD. And we also know that all traumas are not equal. Events where you are singled out and are more interpersonal by nature are more likely to cause PTSD than accidents or natural disasters, things that are impersonal events. So combat or sexual assault, domestic violence, child sexual abuse are much more likely to cause PTSD than impersonal events where many people are involved, like a disaster or a natural disaster or accidents.
Hmm. It's interesting. I know you've written a good deal about this, Matthew, that, you know, Patricia calls combat a personal event, and at one level it makes sense, but at another level, part of the training is to make it as impersonal as possible, yes?
Oh, that's correct, and there's been, you know, lots of writing about that, that one of the strategies in basic training is to dehumanize the enemies. It's a lot easier to kill someone that's not a fellow human than someone who is.
Right.
May I jump in?
Please.
A lot of times the PTSD isn't necessarily about the enemy, though. It may be that one of your friends was killed.
That's right.
Or that you were not able to save someone, or you couldn't stop an event from happening. So there's all combat is not equal.
Hmm. You talked about, Patricia, the risk factors with PTSD. Any protective factors? Is there anything that is available that can help diminish the risk of PTSD going in?
Well, one of the things that's being studied more and more is resilience and trying to do more resilience training. We know after the fact that the level of social support you get is very important, but I think the information you get ahead of time to get you buffered to handle trauma can only help.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we know, as Patricia said a few minutes ago, that most people exposed to traumatic events don't develop PTSD, but some people do. And so some people are more resilient, and some people are more vulnerable. And I think one of the more important areas in our field right now is trying to figure that out so that we can bolster the resilience among the ones that may be more susceptible.
Do we know how to bolster resilience? I know a lot of you know, there's been a lot of work with children and using resilience as depression prevention. Do we know how to bolster resilience?
Well, I think that, first of all, some of the resilience seems to be genetic. I mean, there may be some genetic loading. We, as you know, in terms of athleticism and beauty, we can't pick our parents, and so some of us have parents that have passed on more resilient genes than others. Social support, the more that we can have social support both before, during, and after encountering a traumatic event, the greater the likelihood that we're not going to develop a PTSD. Military psychiatry has looked into leadership and group cohesiveness, which are other factors. We think that the more you know what to expect, the more that you are prepared, the less that the traumatic event is unexpected and that your body's reactions and your mind's reactions to those events are unexpected, so that you can prepare how to train, prepare yourself for those. All of these contribute, but I think it's a work in progress right now.
Patricia, does PTSD in the Iraq-Afghanistan wars look pretty much the same as it did in Vietnam and World War II?
We don't know the full picture yet because it's still going on, and we didn't start actually measuring PTSD in the Vietnam vets until almost 15 years after the war had ended. So by that time, we had the full scope. We know this war is a little bit different in some important ways. One is that we have people going back from multiple deployments. In some ways, it's very similar to Vietnam in terms of the guerrilla-type warfare, not knowing who the enemy is and who the, you know, when you're safe and when you're not safe. It's like everything over there was the war zone, unlike some places where it would be set up as battles in the past or places you knew were, you know, safe. So I think there are some pieces to it that are going to be particularly problematic. But we don't know yet the full scope of what the PTSD will be.
You know, if you go back historically before 1980, before PTSD as a term evolved, there was recognition that people who were in overwhelming situations had different kinds of problems. There was prisoner of war syndrome. There was rape trauma syndrome. There was battered wife syndrome. There was soldier's heart, shell shock, battle fatigue, and so all these different terms or events had different symptom named after them. And I think the part of the importance of the PTSD construct was the recognition that what happens, whether it's rape or combat, it looks very, very similar. It looks very similar behaviorally, clinically. Brain imaging studies look very, very similar. Some of the biological work. So right now, you know, we don't have different varieties of PTSD. That may change with more research, but right now, PTSD is PTSD.
So it looks different on the outside, but on the inside, it's
well,
similar.
To a clinician, it doesn't look that different on the inside either.
Yeah, the symptoms don't look different. The only question is whether we're going to have higher rates for one thing versus another.
That's right.
And that's
right.
The piece we don't know yet. Well, not that it's going to look a different symptom picture.
Speaking of higher rates, I've got a question, I guess, of you, Matthew, and see if I want to get this in before the break when we come back and talk to Jennifer Crane. But I've seen pictures of the inside of tanks and you know, the boards of people operating these drones, and they look exactly like video games. And these young people probably played at home before they went into the military. I wonder, what are the implications of causing the death of somebody you don't see, where it's not real?
You know, I think that's a good question, and we don't have a good answer for it. I can tell you, though, that the American Psychiatric Association began to wonder about this during the Cold War. The question was, you know, was it easier for a pilot flying a plane with a nuclear bomb to drop it when he's not visualizing a human but a small specks? I think the question about these things that you raise are good questions. I'm not aware of any good research on this at this time.
Patricia, you?
I have not heard any research on that particular topic either, but I think sometimes people are rather startled that it's not the sterile thing that the video games, I mean, those don't have smells, those don't have the same level of visual. I mean, they're cartoons, and when you see real damage, and just because you're in a tank doesn't mean you don't see the effects.
So in a way, it could be more shocking.
I think it can be very shocking that these are real human beings involved here.
We're gonna have to take a short break, and we're come back and talk with Jennifer Crane, who's a vet from the Afghanistan War who had symptoms of PTSD. If you're a vet and you've experienced symptoms of PTSD or a loved one has, give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. We're talking with Dr. Matthew Friedman, who is Executive Director of the Department of Veteran Affairs National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and Dr. Patricia Rizik. She's Director of Women's Health Division of the National Center for PTSD. And when we come back, we're going to hear from Jennifer Crane, who's a veteran who returned from a combat tour in Afghanistan. Again, the number is 888-477-9499. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM, Philadelphia.
ChristianaCare supports WHYY and your efforts to stay healthy. ChristianaCare's Helen F. Graham Cancer Center is one of only 14 in the country selected by the National Cancer Institute as a community cancer center program. Patients are offered a team of medical experts backed up by the latest research trials, technology, and a personal care coordinator who guides them every step of the way. More information online at christianacare.org/cancer.
I'm Jim DeRogatis, and today on Sound Opinions, Greg Kot and I are back in session as the Rock Doctors. We'll be tackling our biggest challenge to date.
In short, I'm not the biggest fan of my boyfriend's music.
That's right, we've got not one, but two patients on the line. A couple in love with each other, but not their music.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about PTSD with veterans, and specifically today we're talking about veterans of the Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. My guests are Dr. Matthew Friedman, Executive Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs National Center for PTSD. He's written After the War Zone, A Practical Guide for Returning Troops and Their Families. We're going to talk about that book, too, in a bit. Dr. Patricia Rizik is Director of the Women's Health Division of the National Center for PTSD. And I'm joined now here by Jennifer Crane. She's a veteran who returned from a combat tour in Afghanistan. Jennifer, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm all right. How were you about 10 minutes ago when you were listening to Matthew and Patricia?
Not wonderful. I actually ended up having to take some of my anxiety medication.
What was happening?
Just listening, I think it's probably one of the first times that I've actually heard two civilian doctors come out, and they hit the nail right on the head. Everything, you know, Dr. Friedman talked about the different stages, and everything he mentioned I've been through. And when we start talking about that, I kind of start going back in my head and remembering everything that I've been through, and it's stressful.
You came back from Afghanistan when?
2003.
How were you?
When I came home?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, when I came home, I was very sick. I was actually medevaced out of country. I had lost a significant amount of weight, started suffering from depression during my deployment. And by the time I came home, I was not able to eat. I wasn't sleeping. I got out, and within about a month, I was having night terrors and sweats. And then I started using drugs to keep me from having to sleep and experience those nightmares again. So I definitely was completely different than I was when I left.
What did you do? Did you seek help?
At first I did. I actually went to the Coatesville VA here in Pennsylvania, and I went there and I saw a therapist. She was actually a social worker at the time, and I wasn't pleased with the therapy that I received there. I wasn't comfortable with her. I didn't feel like she understood me. They also pretty much told me at the time they didn't really know what to do with some of the female veterans coming back because it was something they hadn't experienced. So after about two sessions, I stopped going. I decided that I was all alone. There was nobody that could help me, and I walked away.
In a way, you were re-traumatized.
Absolutely.
So you walked away, and then what?
I not only walked away from therapy, but I walked away from all my friends, my family. For the next couple of years, I ended up using drugs to try and self-medicate because I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't have any friends that were military-related that could understand me. I also didn't want to tell anybody because I didn't know what was wrong with me to begin with.
So you were ashamed?
Very much so. Very much so. It was I was a completely different person when I came home. It was somebody I didn't recognize. The relationship I was in fell apart. He didn't know who I was anymore. I completely pulled myself out of my family. They would look at me, and I was the same person, but you know, inside I was completely different.
Yeah. Do you mind telling us a little bit about what you experienced in Afghanistan? And if you do, we don't have to talk about it.
Sure. I'm not going to go into extensive detail, but I could tell you little bits and pieces, at least the parts that have been extremely difficult for me to deal with. I think probably what impacted me the most was that when I went overseas, we had just started the war in Iraq, and I actually deployed within days of us starting that war, and there was no focus on Afghanistan. Nobody heard what was going on. Everybody assumed that it was very quiet and, you know, it wasn't considered a danger zone at this point. So that was difficult, you know, being there and knowing what the reality was and seeing that nobody back home thought that, you know, oh, nothing was going on. While I was there, I worked for base operations. I was a paralegal, so I worked in the main building where all of our security teams, all of our engineering teams, all of our colonels and generals were. We were also the building that the Taliban liked to attack. So within 2 weeks of me being there, we would have mortars coming over our flight line trying to blow up my building. It was a pretty common occurrence. On top of that, we had a lot of suicide bombers that would come and they would blow up the buildings right outside of our base. And at our base, we had what they called the intensive care worldwide, where we treated not only our soldiers, but also local nationals.
Jennifer, what happened to you when you were over there, when that was happening? What happened to you?
Nothing at that moment. At least I didn't think so at the time. I shut down. The first time we were ever attacked, I was running around. I was just, you know, I have to do my job. This is what I need to do. And then when it was over, I didn't really have a response to it.
What do you mean when it was over? When that particular day was over?
When that particular incident
event,
was over.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. When I really didn't have a response at the time. I can remember calling my family and telling them, yeah, this is what happened. I'm okay. Everything's fine. And very much blew it off. I don't think I realized at that moment that I actually was just internalizing everything. I know that now, but in order to do your job as a soldier, you learn to just shut down. You'll get killed if you don't. You know, if you allow yourself to become wrapped up in your emotions and your feelings and what might be hurting you at the time, you're not going to be looking out for yourself.
Right, and you couldn't know how vulnerable you were.
I had no idea.
How frightened you were. You couldn't know that.
I was 20 years old. I had no idea. I was still a kid. I had no idea what kind of impact this was going to have on me, my life, and or that I was even having an adverse reaction at the time.
Hmm. How are you right at the moment?
Today?
No, this moment. Not today. Right now.
A little anxious.
Are you?
Yeah,
scale
a little
from
bit.
1 to 10?
About a 6.
Hmm. And how were you 10 minutes ago when you were listening to Matthew and Patricia?
About an 11.
Yeah, I could see. I could see. What's the difference? What changed?
Well, first of all, anxiety medication is a wonderful thing.
Okay.
You know, I am today, I take my medication, and I take it when I need it, how I need it, and, you know, I make sure to stay on that course so I can live a full life. That's first. But also, when I speak, I feel more in control of the situation. So that makes it easier for me.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm just listening or I'm watching, that's in a completely different situation. I also avoid the news, and I avoid, you know, different movies and things that, you know, I don't want to be exposed to. Even certain songs I avoid, and having to listen to, you know, two other people pretty much tell my story without me having to say a word
is a little weird.
A little weird.
Yeah, I don't know if Matthew would agree with me, but I don't know if not listening to the news is a symptom of PTSD or a symptom of mental health for all of us. Matthew and Patricia, I'd like to bring you both back in. Patricia, there's something Jennifer said that struck me. She said she went to the VA, she saw a clinician there, and the clinician almost acknowledged that she didn't know about treating PTSD in women. Were you shocked by hearing that?
No, not if she went in 2003. Things have changed dramatically in the last few years, where people are getting a lot more training in PTSD and treatment of PTSD and using effective treatments for PTSD. So I would urge Jennifer to give it another try, because the VA has changed a lot since 2003. In fact, they've changed a lot since 2006.
Yeah, I'd like to second that, Jennifer. Please give it another chance. Things are a lot different now than they were when you first tried.
Well, then let's follow that up, because I happen to know something you guys don't know, and that's she did give it another chance. So let's do the follow-up. When did you give another chance, Jennifer, and why?
It was 2006, and I had kind of come to my breaking point.
What was it?
I got arrested for drug use and drug possession. And I actually went to a drug court program, which made sure that I had to stay, you know, clean and sober. It set me up with a therapist. And after that period, I ended up at the VA. I decided to go up there for substance abuse. And I said, there's something wrong. And I walked in their doors, and they took me in, you know, open arms. I was in the substance abuse treatment unit for 2 weeks. And during that time, I was evaluated by their PTSD unit on the same location as the substance abuse treatment.
I would imagine the PTSD unit has to be right there.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And they evaluated me, decided that I had chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, and they actually put me into their treatment facility, and I lived at the VA for 3 months.
Receiving treatment for PTSD.
Yes.
Well, I know, certainly Patricia and Matthew and I are interested, and many of our listeners. What kind of treatment did you get? How was it different than it was with that social worker?
With the social worker, I was just sitting there. She was trying to get me to talk about what I was experiencing, and I don't think at that time I was ready to completely tell somebody what I was going through. And by the time I had reached the post-traumatic unit at the VA, you know, 3 years later, I was in a much different place. You know, I wanted the help. I realized that, you know, my life was in shambles and I was going nowhere, and this wasn't the life that I was supposed to have. So I think part of it was about my mindset, first of all. And the other part was, at the post-traumatic unit, you were inpatient. You lived with many other soldiers from Vietnam. There was Vietnam veterans, Afghanistan veterans, and Iraqi veterans there, all different age groups, and we were all the same. So it was huge to see that you're surrounded by people who understand you. You no longer feel alone. So that, I think that's a huge part of the process there, is to be able to be surrounded by people who understand you. The doctors that I had seemed to be very, very well versed in how to treat us. So I went to therapy once a day. I did group therapy. I also did biofeedback. You know, they'd connect you to all sorts of little electrodes, and they monitor your anxiety levels, like when you close your eyes versus when you're awake, or when you're in a dark room, and what kind of environments seem to trigger you. They also tried some re-exposure treatments with me, which unfortunately at the time were probably the wrong thing to do. But you got to try to see what works for you.
Well, it's got to be reassuring. Any of us who've had medical problems know the feeling of being reassured when you feel like you're with somebody who knows what the hell they're doing.
Absolutely.
You know, that helps diminish anxiety right there. I want to come back and talk to you, Matthew, and Patricia. Jennifer talked about the value of inpatient, feeling less isolated, more connected. That's going to be extremely therapeutic for anybody who's in a hospital. Would that be a treatment of choice?
Not of first choice. I think both Patricia and I said earlier that one of the most protective factors is social support, and these can be achieved through, you know, families, through friends. If you're totally isolated, and it sounds, Jennifer, like you had, as you said, you kind of pushed everybody away and you were all by yourself, and sounds like you also were in a very, very bad situation, so that you were arrested. That I think for more extreme cases, such as yours was at that time, perhaps inpatient is the best way to go. But most people can benefit quite a great deal from outpatient treatments. We have a network of vet centers nationally. There are other kinds of group contexts. We've certainly been working both locally and nationally to encourage people, if they're active duty, to be involved in some of the supportive options on military bases for the Guard and reservists through other networks. So I think that inpatient treatment sometimes is necessary, and sounds like it was necessary and effective, but it's not always or usually the case.
Jennifer?
Yeah, the one thing I did have to say was it doesn't seem like there's a lot of treatment available for the Guard and reservists. That's the one problem that we're having, is that when they come home, they're not being told, here, this is where you go. You know, the debriefing, I'm hoping, has changed, at least since I was in, because I was originally a part of the Guard, and I had no idea that any of the treatments were available, and primarily because we're expected to reintegrate right back into society when we come home, you see a lot more of the post-traumatic, at least I have, through the people who were National Guard or reservists. Yeah. That was the first thing. The second thing was, I honestly don't know any soldier or former soldier who has had success with outpatient treatment, just primarily because they're not in a situation where they feel comfortable enough. And yeah, that's just been what I've seen.
Well, let's talk about that then. I want to turn to Matthew and Patricia. What about this issue of what's available for people when they come out? Are they being screened for PTSD, and is treatment made available? And Jennifer also brings up an interesting issue about the Guard. Anybody want to tackle that?
Well, I'll jump in to start with. Everybody who walks in to a VA hospital is screened for PTSD. And over the last couple of years, the VA has hired almost, I think, more than 4,000 new mental health workers to deal with a lot of these issues. And we've been doing massive training since 2007 of the new, not just the new people, but people who had not been trained in specialized treatments for PTSD since the spring of 2007. You know, we started kind of rolling out these treatments in 2006, but probably didn't get to every VA hospital in the country until more recently. I think there has been a problem at least in the past, and I think we're starting to do better with the Guard and the Reserve. They do have a problem when they're not with their units, and they head right back in, and they are expected to reintegrate immediately, because I don't think they have the military culture supporting them once they get back home, and I think people sometimes don't understand what they've been through, particularly early in the war.
Exactly.
So I think as time has gone by, we've gotten a little better. But it's always going to be a problem for someone if they live far away from a VA hospital and they can't get the outpatient services. We've been doing more with trying to actually develop telehealth, which means kind of doing therapy even at a distance if we need to, or finding local places that we can do it. So we're trying to meet the needs, but there are people scattered all over the country.
Well, there's also a program called Give an Hour. Jennifer, you're familiar with that, yes?
Yes, I am.
I mean, that's how you got. Tell us about that program.
Yeah, Give an Hour actually is a program. It's on a website. It's www.giveanhour.org, and you go on there, and it's a nonprofit organization that gives free mental health care to veterans, veterans' family members, friends of veterans, anybody who's been affected by the war. And it's actually civilian psychologists that donate their time, an hour a week or an hour per person, to provide free mental health care to people who are seeking it out.
Well, I want to get a call in but I want to talk about the details, and specifically with you, Patricia, about what good therapy is and what it's not. But let's get a call in first. There's another issue that needs to be brought up. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling in because my kid's father is a Vietnam combat veteran. He was on the demilitarized zone in Quang Tri province. We saw some, I'm sure, really horrible things. We split up when the children were very young because I mean, nobody knew about PTSD then, I don't think. At least I surely didn't.
Right.
And I could not handle sort of the deterioration that I saw happening before my eyes and his or my inability to do anything about it. He started out with a really great job, going to graduate school, and, you know, sort of successively went to lesser and lesser and lesser jobs in terms of being underemployed. Subsequently, he ended up homeless. He lost his car. It was repossessed. He lost his driver's license. Right now, he is not homeless, but he's not living in a situation where his children can visit him.
Does he want to get treatment?
And he refuses. He absolutely refuses. He has always refused. Is there any way, is there any agency, is there any person who can hold someone like that's hand and take them through treatment? Because
let's see, treatment. Matthew, Patricia.
Well, you know, I mean, I think you put your finger on the main problem, which is that your ex-husband has refused treatment. I mean, unfortunately, you know, Vietnam ended before PTSD was a diagnosis, before all of the work that's happened in the past almost 30 years to evolve treatments and assessments and for the VA and for the civilian sector as well to develop the treatments and programs so that you can't force anybody to undergo treatment. And frankly, if people aren't motivated for treatment, it's often problematic. Sometimes in court-ordered situations, it does work, but most people are not in a court-ordered situation. It might be useful for your ex-husband, if he's willing, to check out a vet center. There's plenty of vet centers in Pennsylvania and where he could meet the fellow Vietnam and veterans of other eras and at least have a place to hang out for starters, and let the other vets tell him how they have or haven't benefited.
Let me ask you this, Matthew. I want to ask specifically, pick up Susan's language. Is there anyone that can hold his hand and take him to treatment? Is there anyone, any agency that could go to his house?
Well, you know, again, it's a tough call because if he is dead set against this, then that might force him to retreat even further.
Even there more out of control.
There are vet-to-vet programs in this is a national program in each state. Perhaps he could do that, but as you know, and I think as all the listeners know, if people are refusing to accept the potential help that's available, it's very hard to force it upon them, and we can't force it, and we shouldn't force it upon them.
Well, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about what treatments work, what treatments don't, what therapists need to know, among other things. My guests are Dr. Matthew Friedman, Executive Director of the Veteran Affairs National Center for PTSD. He's written After the War Zone, A Practical Guide for Returning Troops and Their Families. Dr. Patricia Rizek is Director of Women's Health Division, National Center for PTSD. And I'm also joined here in the studio by Jennifer Crane. She's a veteran who returned from a combat tour in Afghanistan in 2003 and suffered and suffers symptoms of PTSD. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you're a vet, give us a call, or someone you know and love is a vet who's experienced PTSD, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Kimmel Center Presents supports WHYY and welcomes Kodo Drummers to Verizon Hall Tuesday, March 17th. Inspired by Western classical music and jazz, this 14-member percussion group strives to preserve traditional Japanese culture along with a contemporary taiko drum. Instruments range from handheld cymbals to the 800-pound odaiko. Kodo Drummers, Tuesday, March 17th at the Kimmel Center. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or kimmelcenter.org.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about PTSD with returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm joined here in the studio by Jennifer Crane, who's a veteran returned from a combat tour in 2003 from Afghanistan. Patricia Rizek is Director of Women's Health Division of the National Center for PTSD, and Matthew Friedman is Executive Director of the Department of Veteran Affairs National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. So let's talk about what treatments work and what treatment don't. Jennifer, you're seeing an outpatient therapist now.
Yes.
What kind of treatment are you getting?
Well, we spend a lot of time doing what really I want to do, quite frankly, because I've been told I'm kind of hard to treat sometimes because I'll get homework, I'll be given certain things to do, and then I just won't do them. It all depends on my mood. We work a lot on trying to...
You think you're different than anybody else?
No.
Nobody does homework.
No, I don't think so at all. We work a lot on... I'm trying to get a better understanding of how my thoughts, you know, become actions and how my behaviors lead to certain things, and also... deciphering what is post-traumatic and what is just a normal everyday part of life. And that's something I struggled with for a long time. My therapist, she talks a lot about cognitive therapy, and I don't know the definition, but I do know that whatever we do works.
Well, you're about to find out. Patricia, you know, we are trained, we therapists are trained to ask the question, well, how do you feel? And, you know, that's originally how we, you know, began treating PTSD. But it turns out that's exactly the wrong question.
Yes, the question is, what do you think?
Right, right. And why is that? I mean, all of the new therapies, cognitive behavior, and I want to talk much more about CPT, cognitive processing therapy. Why is that? Why are we going after thoughts rather than emotions?
Well, the way I think about it is your emotions are sort of like the outcome of your thoughts and the outcome of what happened to you.
it's like taking your temperature. It'd be like trying to fix the fever rather than the cause. And so what we do is we focus on what is attached to those emotions. If somebody comes up and assaults me, my natural emotion might be to feel fear or to feel anger. My cognitively distorted emotion might be because I'm blaming myself. I should have predicted it ahead of time. I should have known this was going to happen. I should have stopped it. And
yeah.
So you'd have a very different emotion than if you had that thought. You'd start feeling guilt or shame or angry at yourself or something. And so what we have to do is sort through what kind of emotions someone is having. So we do ask what they're feeling. But then we try to figure out, is it coming naturally from that traumatic event, or is it because of some conclusion they drew or some thought that they had about why it happened? And that helps us figure out whether we want them to help focus on their natural feelings and let them feel the natural feelings of the event, or the ones that they have gotten derailed by that are based on what they said. And that's what a cognitive therapy approach would do.
Answer your question, Jennifer?
No, I was just going to say that right along those same lines, there's one particular event that I've struggled with more than anything, and it was one where I was actually on my flight out of country, and I've watched my lieutenant colonel die literally right in front of me. He had a cardiac arrest, and he was over-sedated, and without too many details, it was horrifying. He was 5 feet in front of me, and I took that home with me, and that experience turned into me deciding that I was wrong in some way, shape, or form, that I should have been able to do something to help him. And that's been probably one of the hardest things that I've had to deal with, and one of the biggest struggles I've had, is I tend to blame myself for a lot of things because either A, I'm not able to deal with it properly the way that, you know, society thinks I should, or that I think I should, or I put blame in places where it's not actually justified, but I thought it was at the time.
I want to turn to you, Patricia, to get a consultation as a clinician.
Okay.
All right. So I hear Jennifer's story, and when I hear that in my office, now I'm not talking about somebody with PTSD, but when I hear that in my office, what I'm hearing is somebody who the underlying emotion of all that is helpless, just overwhelming helplessness that can't be managed. So the mind does all sorts of games to deal with the helplessness, you know, the self-blame or the shame or the whatever it is, the guilt. But the emotion is helplessness, yes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but it also can become shame and blame and self-blame and so forth. She just gave a great example of how, if I were to do cognitive processing therapy with her, we would go back and revisit that event and look at all the thoughts that were attached to it, whether it's a just world belief, like how can this happen on his way out, or what should I have done, what are the implications for me, what does all this mean? We would sort through all that. But it's not me talking her out of it. We'd be teaching her the skills
to do this
for herself.
That's an important distinction. Matthew, I want to turn to you and talk about the family of returning soldiers. The book I referred to, After the War Zone, A Practical Guide for Returning Troops and Their Families. What's the message here?
Well, the message is first of all, that, and Jennifer said it very well, that anybody who's been away on a deployment for a year or several deployments, they're going to be changed by their experience. But that while they're away, their family, the people left behind, are also going to be changed in order to reconfigure the family, how to make things work. And so that when there is a reunification, people have to get reacquainted. This isn't about PTSD. This is about what happens in life. The military calls it reintegration. So that the premise of the book is that this reintegration process, which is complicated, it's not about PTSD, it's not about psychiatry for the most part, it's about getting that there are going to be speed bumps, that you can't just pick up and where you left off 12 months ago. It doesn't work that way.
So what does one have to do to make it better?
Well, that's why we wrote this book. We'd been working both nationally and also locally with the Vermont National Guard, and we were watching this thing play out, and there are all kinds of speed bumps, whether it's about anger management, adolescent kids that have gotten used to being autonomous without a, say, a father being in the house, aren't going to be thrilled that curfews are going to be imposed when he comes back. We don't get to things like PTSD or depression until way past the middle of the book. It's all about what to expect. What kinds of problems might there be in terms of family roles, in terms of attachment? People who come back may have memories that they don't want to deal with. That's not PTSD. May have problems expressing emotions. That's not necessarily PTSD either. You pointed out earlier on that this stuff is on a continuum, and for most people, where that stuff is nowhere near the clinical arena that needs a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but it's stuff that can truly affect a family dynamic. And we felt that there was no book out there to help. We wrote the book for families and for returning servicemen and women. It's not for
I also want to note, because we've got to close just a few seconds, that you made that book pretty inexpensive too, that reason.
That was the deal. I told the publisher I wasn't going to write the book unless people could pay afford it. So we insisted that it be $15 or under. That was part of the deal.
Well, that's great. And obviously, then, because it was cheap, you didn't make enough money on that book to retire because you're still working. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us today. I think it's been a great informative show and a terribly important one. My guests today have been Dr. Matthew Friedman. He's Executive Director, U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. The book we were just talking about is called After the War Zone, A Practical Guide for Returning Troops and Their Families. We also spoke with Dr. Patricia Rezik, Director of Women's Health Division of the National Center for PTSD. She's a professor of psychiatry and psychology at Boston University. And we heard from veteran Jennifer Crane, who shared her story with us. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
She also is getting her treatment now as a result of givenhour.org. To all therapists out there, please look it up. It's givenhour.org. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll talk about new research on eating disorders. Tune in to Morning Edition this Wednesday to hear a story of a man affected by PTSD as part of the Impact of War series. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Scotty Williams and Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Our executive producers, Mike and Scott. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.